It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, about the time we were doing the show last week, of course, neither of us knew that this had happened, but there was the shooting up on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, not too far away from here, actually. Yeah, there's really not a whole lot you can say about it. Just one of those things that happened, really. Although, you know, our local media managed to find things to say about it all week long. A couple of comments, though. One that I was really grateful to see that the initial efforts at scapegoating, whether that be, you know, gun control or parental negligence, or especially the rave scene, were not successful. The Seattle Times had a dreadful editorial on Monday morning, basically, railing about those irritating young people and their boundless energy and insistence on dancing to rhythmic music, which is what happens when you get editorial boards controlled by 60-year-old white men. But they were basically pushing for a reinstatement of something like the teen dance ordinance and blaming the shooting on the rave scene, and which was just totally, totally out of bounds. I mean, this could have happened in conjunction with any large group. There's some degree of evidence that that Huff was actually stalking the rave scene for several weeks. We know that last Saturday, because he had all the guns and ammo in his truck, he had to have it in his truck when he went to the original rave on Capitol Hill at the Art Center in 12th and Pine. And I would just be thankful that he didn't open fire there. But, it's actually quite the opposite, that the rave scene is one of those youth subcultures, along with, you know, punk rock and hip-hop are the other two that come to mind. And I'm sure there are others that an old fogey like me is no longer aware of. But they're basically outcast youth. And unlike punk and hip-hop, rave is very outgoing and accommodating. It's sort of like this unconditional acceptance no matter who you are. You have a place in the scene. And that's going to be very, very difficult to maintain now. Already the two largest rave events in Seattle this weekend have been canceled because of the tragedy last weekend. And, you know, it's going to be very hard for somebody in that scene to maintain that kind of openness in their heart when, you know, some grumpy looking guy next to them, appears to be in a bad mood and isn't very responsive, when a little voice in your head is wondering in the back, well, you know, does this guy have a truckload of guns and ammo in the parked out back? It's going to really change that scene in some fundamental ways. And it's really, really unfortunate to see, but it was good to see that politicians put a break to that kind of backlash movement and said later in the week, no, we're not going to do anything to further control raves or all ages shows of any kind. And that part was good, but the shooting itself was just horrific, and I think, you know, struck a chord with an awful lot of people. That's a neighborhood that a lot of people have lived in here in Seattle over the years, and it felt very close and very personal to a lot of people.
Moving along, the city council was busy this week.
Yeah, there were several things that happened on Monday in the city and county council, most of which didn't get a lot of attention because this local media was still so obsessed with the Capitol Hill shooting. Probably the most significant, we talked about it on the show last week, was the council's decision to adapt a so-called compromise offered by Sally Clark and cover public funding of the cost overruns of the Southland Union's streetcar trolley. Now this is a project that's already run substantially over budget. The two alternatives were either to take money from the general fund or to take money or to assess money against property owners that will benefit directly by the trolley. Well, the assessment of property owners, which is of course opposed by Vulcan and some of the other property owners, did not succeed. Instead, the quote unquote compromise was to take money from a fund that's been set up by Mayor Nichols, which in turn is taken from the general fund. So basically, it's still taxpayer money that's going to be used to cover millions of dollars worth of cost overruns to this streetcar trolley. And it's also kind of discouraging because it sets a precedent for how to handle a much bigger project for which a specific group of property owners is going to benefit vastly, and that's the question of what to do with the Alaskan Way Viaduct. If you have either a tunnel option or a waterfront boulevard option, and those are probably the two leading options, although it's not clear that the waterfront boulevard will be on the November ballot. Either one of those options is going to vastly increase the property value of everything from Western Avenue on over towards the water. And particularly when you're talking about the tunnel, which is a much more expensive option, you know, why not assess some of that cost to the property owners in the area who will see their property values skyrocket once you get the big freeway out of their backyard? That may not happen now because the city council has already said that's not an appropriate course of action when you have private property owners that are going to benefit vastly from a publicly subsidized transportation works. So that may make the tunnel option more difficult to justify funding.
City Council was also working this week on daylighting of creeks.
Yeah, also on Monday, it passed an interesting measure that allows the city to decide whether the daylighting of creeks is whether the financial cost of it outweighs or does not outweigh the environmental benefits each time a redevelopment plan comes up before the city that that would involve a creek somewhere that is not daylighted, which is actually quite a few of them around the Seattle area. This is something that developers opposed. Nichols City Hall has opposed, but the city council has passed it, and it's going to become law. So that's good news. The county council also did something interesting on Monday. They passed on a strict 5-4 vote, strictly party lines. The Democrats all approved, the Republicans all opposed, adding to the non-discrimination laws of King County that you can't discriminate based on the basis of quote-unquote gender identity. Now, that covers not only gays, lesbians, and bisexuals, it also covers transsexuals. And this is being done in advance of Tim Eymann's measure that will likely be on the ballot this fall trying to overturn the state gay civil rights bill. What King County is doing is trying to put a measure in place that will offer, you know, those same protections even if the statewide measure is overturned.
Also, there was a city council had a hearing this last Thursday dealing with funding for SCAN, the Seattle Community Access Network, which was very well attended.
Mm-hmm.
And also that wanted to point out to listeners that they have basically a week left to get their comments into city council about whether SCAN should be fully funded or not.
Or funded at all. I mean, you know, I mean, you know, public access in the cable system in the Seattle area is not something you can take for granted. There's a lot of pressure underway to cut it off entirely, which is not the case for most cable systems in the country. So it's something worth fighting for.
Yeah. And actually, well, Comcast has, in several cities across the country, has, like, nuked the public access system there. So it looks like a trend that's growing unless people voice their opinion on it. So moving over to the state level, the Washington state here is did some work this week on a disenfranchisement law.
Yeah, we had a court ruling this week at the state level that struck down Washington's felon disenfranchisement law. And what this is that when you are convicted of a felony in Washington state, you lose the right to vote. You can regain the right to vote, but not only does it have to be after you've served your prison term, it also has to be after you've paid off all fines and restitutions. And Washington State is one of the leading states in the country for assessing costs to prison time, whether that's a fine, whether that's restitution, whether that's having to pay for part or all of the cost of your incarceration itself, court costs, whatever it is. And of course, most felons, by the time they get out of prison, are destitute. They have no source of income. They have no savings. A lot of them were poor to begin with. And they're disproportionately people of color in this state compared to their populations. And so what you get is a voting law that effectively penalizes people based on their ability to pay. It's a poll tax, in other words, and it disproportionately affects people of color. Well, this has drawn a lot of attention over the last year or so. The New York Times even editorialized against it. And the courts ruled this week that it was unconstitutional. It was overturned. Unfortunately, Sam Reed, the otherwise pretty moderate Republican Secretary of State, and Rob McKenna, the not necessarily moderate at all, Attorney General, also a Republican, announced that they are going to appeal this ruling to the state Supreme Court. So this is not a done deal yet, but it's certainly encouraging that the lower court overturned it, because it really is a very bad and very unfair setup for Washington State felons, which is a surprisingly large number of people, particularly in the African-American community.
And kind of bridging the gap between state and national, there's been some significant protests, as well as are currently, over immigration issues.
Yeah, and in fact, there's one going on today. The Minutemen are in town, the grassroots group that doesn't like brown people. And what they're doing today in Seattle is they're going to go around to different big box stores and protest their hiring of people based on having brown skin, because if they have brown skin, of course, they must be illegal aliens. And so Casa Latina is organizing counter-demonstrations against this. The first shift already started from 7 until 10 o'clock this morning. They got them over to Casa Latina, fed them breakfast, and bussed them off to wherever the Minutemen are. But there's another shift that's going to start at 10 o'clock. That's a little less than an hour and a half from now, over at Casa Latina, the... where is this now? The Day Workers Center. It's at 2330 Western Avenue, Western and Battery, in Belltown. Chug on over there at 10 o'clock. They'll probably have refreshments, and then they'll send you off to counter protest the Minutemen. Now, the Minutemen is kind of an interesting phenomenon, because it's one of the only two sides in the immigration debate that's being heard. You have the xenophobes on the one side, in the far right, and then you have the corporatists on the other side, the big agribusiness, some of the other big corporate interests in the United States, who like their cheap, powerless labor just fine, thank you very much, and so really like the idea of some sort of a guest worker program that would cement into law the ability of employers to, hold an enormous sword over these immigrant workers until they have some kind of a legal status that isn't dependent on one particular job. We have competing bills in this House and the Senate. The House bill is what has drawn these enormous protests. A million plus people, by some estimates, in Los Angeles last weekend. Demonstrations in Phoenix and Miami and Denver, and of course a couple weeks ago in Chicago. All over the country. We've had some in Washington State as well. Controversy going over in Yakima right now, because two different schools had student walkouts on Monday. And at one of those schools, all the students who walk out are being faced with suspension. At the other one, they're not. Here in King County, there were four different high schools plus Highline Community College, all of which walk out on Monday, held a little rally down in SeaTac. You have some agitation still going on there. But the Senate and House bills, the Senate decided earlier this week not to adapt in their version of immigration reform the measure in the House bill, which would criminalize anybody who gives assistance to somebody that knowingly or not that is not legally in this country, and that could mean anything. That could be my talking about it on the radio. I mean, that could be giving assistance to somebody who's not giving, certainly anybody at a food bank or a social service, anything like that. So it's not just non-citizens and not just the immigrant communities who are up in arms about this, but also the social service communities. Anybody really who cares about social justice. And in the cities that have large immigrant populations, large enough that they have kind of a toehold in local media, which they really don't in Seattle, that's why you've had these enormous protests, because an awful lot of people are affected by this, not just people who have snuck across the border in the middle of the night. The danger with the House and Senate bills is that even if the Senate doesn't adopt these extreme measures, the bills will have to be reconciled in conference, and those measures can be reintroduced then. So that's why it's important to really keep the pressure up, keep these demonstrations going over the next few weeks. So Casa Latina, 10 o'clock, go confront the Minutemen, 2330 Western Avenue, and I'll repeat that at the end of the show.
Yeah, that was amazing. The low ball estimate on Los Angeles was 500,000.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that was the smallest estimate.
Yeah.
And, you know, equally amazing to me was 500,000 in Phoenix. I mean, Phoenix has never had more than 300 people for a demonstration in its civic existence, as far as I know. So that was really quite impressive.
All right. Well, moving along, there were updates this week in the Abramoff scandal.
Yeah, Tony Rudy, former chief of staff for Tom DeLay, you may recognize the name, became the third major figure to plead guilty in the Jack Abramoff scandal this week on charges that he, quote, accepted several trips, Redskins tickets, a trip to the Daytona 500, golf clubs, of course, and, of course, there was also the $115,000 to Christine DeLay through Rudy and his wife's consulting firm, the Alexander Strategy Group, that he set up along with Edwin Buckham, another former chief of staff for Tom DeLay, who's probably the next person in the crosshairs. Alexander Strategy Group, incidentally, was also involved in with Brent Wilkes and the Randy Cunningham scandal. So all of these people know each other. It's kind of fascinating. But Rudy has gone down now. He's agreed to plead guilty. He is facing $250,000 in fines, another $100,000 in restitution, and up to 5 years in prison, although it's doubtful he'll get that much. His indictment has more information on Robert Nye, the congressman from Ohio. Also, implicates Buckham. Does not implicate DeLay, but the prosecutors are clearly circling around Tom DeLay. It may not matter whether he gets reelected to his seat or not, because one way or another, you get the sense that he's going down. The other interesting development this week was down in Florida, where Abramoff himself, along with Adam Kittim, who was his business partner in the Sun Cruise Casinos venture, they had pleaded guilty to wire fraud and conspiracy charges in conjunction with their purchase of that company, purchased from a man, incidentally, who was assassinated about a year later, and Kittim is under investigation in conjunction with that killing as well. But Kittim and Abramoff both received sentences this week in that case of 5 years and 10 months in prison, and then Abramoff is still awaiting sentencing on his D.C. connections. So now you've got Abramoff, Scanlon, and Rudy all helping investigators to try and determine how many congressmen were involved in the corruption scandal in ways that clearly broke the law. At least a dozen Republican names have been mentioned as being under investigation. At least four dozen congresspeople, mostly Republicans, have been mentioned as clearly have been taking money from Abramoff and his clients and or his clients in return for favorable action on legislation. So we're going to be hearing a lot more about this as the year drags on.
All right. And as well, there are some people believe that Karl Rove could be in the crosshairs for indictment.
Yes. This is for the Valerie Plame scandal. Jason Leopold, who's had a number of very good reports on Patrick Fitzgerald's investigation for Truth Out, is reporting this week that Fitzgerald is perhaps a month, maybe a little over a month away from indicting Karl Rove and or Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, for their role in leaking Valerie Wilson's identity as a covert CIA operative. Also interesting this week were some revelations that the Plame affair was actually the far smaller part of a much larger White House cover-up, and that was because George Bush had deniability in the Niger yellow cake uranium scandal. That is, he made the claim in a State of the Union address that Saddam was trying to purchase yellow cake uranium from Niger, but he could honestly claim, at least this is how the story goes, that he didn't know that that information was false, even though many of his advisors and the CIA and State Department certainly did. But George Bush explicitly knew that the story that Iraq was purchasing aluminum tubes for the process of operating as a nuclear centrifuge. He knew that story was false, and he made that claim a number of times in the run-up to the Iraq war. And this was the purpose of directing so much attention toward Valerie Plame, it turns out, when that story broke. It was an effort to divert attention away from the aluminum tubes, at least as long as the 2004 elections, so that that nobody would know before those elections that George Bush was specifically and knowingly peddling false information for justification for the Iraq War. You know, we know that now in 100 different ways. And in fact, we had another memo come out this week, which was originally reported a month ago in Philippe Sands' book in Britain, got a lot of attention over there, but no attention here. The report in the New York Times this week got it a little more attention here, that a memo from David Manning, then Tony Blair's chief foreign policy advisor, from a meeting on January 30th, 2003, that is about 2 months before the invasion, was talking about Bush being determined to go to war, that he wasn't going to take a yes for an answer, that it didn't matter what the inspectors found, it didn't matter what the UN Security Council did, and of course all this was completely contrary to assertions by both Bush and Blair at the time and continuing in the weeks and months leading up to the war.
All right, well, we're going to jump to international. Israeli elections.
Yeah, important elections this week in Israel. I can't even say his name. I should probably learn to. Ehud Olmert is the man who was the interim prime minister to replace Ariel Sharon. He is now the prime minister for Sharon's Kadima party, which won a sweeping victory this week. The interesting part of the elections was that not only did Kadima win in its first national election, but the Labor came second. Likud, which has one way or another, not only it itself, but also its sort of ethnic of extreme Zionism, that is the whole idea of Greater Israel, that Israel deserved to hang on to all of the lands that it occupied after the 1967 war. That's more or less been the goal of the Israeli government for the last 30 years. And that was up for referendum in this election, compared to Sharon and now Olmert's policy of unilateral disengagement, that having already been done in Gaza, and the plan being to do some of that on West Bank and to take over some other areas of West Bank, but not to negotiate with the Palestinians at all, just to erect the wall, probably erect new borders somewhere close to what the apartheid wall is, and pretend that the Palestinians don't exist, essentially. But, you know, take all the water rights, take all of the economic development with you, and leave the Palestinians in a state of destitution. The unilateralism option won resoundingly in the Israeli elections. This is really the first time that the Israeli public has said, no, we don't want to try to hang on to all of the 1967 lands. So that's a good sign in a way. But the way that it's being implemented is still deeply problematic, and was underscored again this week by the United States announcing that it is not going to have any dealings whatsoever with that part of the Palestinian Authority that answers to the legislative branch, so long as the legislative branch is controlled by Hamas. They'll still deal with the Prime Minister, Mahmoud Abbas, who's part of the Fatah party, and the executive branch that answers to him, but we won't deal with anybody having to do with Hamas. Now, and this is kind of patently ridiculous, because it's the United States that's been making all these noises about democracy in the Middle East, and so they have democratic elections in the Middle East, and we don't want to deal with the person that the democratically elected party wants to put in a position of power there. So, go figure.
All right. Let's move over to Iraq.
Yeah, same thing's happening in Iraq this week. The United States is pushing hard, and George Bush came out specifically and said that, that he did not want the current prime minister, Ibrahim al-Jafari, the Shiite, to remain as prime minister, even though that's who the Shiites want, and the Shiites overwhelmingly won the December 15th election. Of course, they're still trying to form a unity government. Then the Shiites are angry at the United States. They've pulled out of talks for a unity government based on that, and also based on anger over an incident last Sunday in which the United States allegedly went into a mosque in northeast Baghdad, killed 16 people as they were worshiping this for morning prayers, and these people were unarmed and so forth. And there's extensive video evidence of this. Unfortunately, the United States is saying, no, this wasn't even a mosque at all. It was a community center, and there were huge chunks of arms and whatnot. And there was even this remarkable quote from Lieutenant General Peter Shirelli, the second-ranking U.S. commander in Iraq, that, quote, after the fact, someone went in and made the scene look different than it was, somehow implying that we didn't really kill all of those people. So the Shiites are really, really upset at the United States this week for that. A number of other things in Iraq this week. A report that came out that said 25,000 Iraqis and counting, both Sunnis and Shiites, have been displaced from the places where they lived, their neighborhoods, since the February 22nd bombing at Samarra because of inter-ethnic tensions. That is, Shiites being forced to move from Sunni neighborhoods and vice versa. So we're seeing a sort of widespread displacement taking place that's clearly part of the sectarian violence and the low-level civil war. We had a report from Henry Waxman, the Democrat from California, who's done a lot of investigative work on Iraq, a report by his staff this week, once again dealing with Halliburton, that they overcharged and did substandard work on a $1.2 billion contract to restore southern Iranian oil fields. We had Jill Carroll, the Christian Science Monitor reporter, being released on Thursday. She was kidnapped January 7th by a still unknown group. That received an awful lot of media attention the last couple of days. What did not receive a lot of attention was a statement by the U.S. Embassy at the same time saying that 10 to 20 Iraqis have been kidnapped each and every day for the last 3 years since the invasion. So while we pay all of this attention to Jill Carroll and members of the Christian Peacemaker team and various other foreigners who've been kidnapped in Iraq, this is a daily fact of life for Iraqis. And finally, we had a couple of remarkable statements by George Bush this week. One, of course, was that he wanted more regime change by not having al-Jafari back as the prime minister. The other one was another one of Bush's striking refusals to admit accountability for what's gone wrong in Iraq. He was referring to tensions between Shiites and Sunnis, and of course he wouldn't dare call this civil war, but he has acknowledged sectarian violence, and it's not his fault, of course. It's not the fault of the United States. It's Saddam's fault. I don't understand why it's not Bill Clinton's fault. I mean, they blame 9/11 on Bill Clinton. Why not blame this on Bill Clinton as well?
I saw on Now last night that they had a report that the number of U.S. soldiers being killed in Afghanistan is equal to that in terms of percentages as in Iraq, that even though there's fewer soldiers, the rate is still the same. So
and we had a couple of real ugly episodes involving deaths of soldiers in Afghanistan this week, too, and it got very little attention.
Events happening this week.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, the Minutemen are in town protesting all those icky brown people, and so there's counter-demonstrations against that going on this morning. Assemble at 10 o'clock at the Casa Latina Day Workers Center, wear workers' clothing in solidarity, and they'll bus you off to wherever the Minutemen are, probably at some big box store protesting the hiring of people who might be illegal aliens. So check that out. Also going on today, for people who are interested in conscientious objection to military taxation, tax time is coming up. If you're interested in war tax resistance, there will be an introductory workshop on it and counselors available, sponsored by the Nonviolent Action Community of Cascadia. That'll be at University Friends Meeting from 1 to 4 o'clock. It is free. Tomorrow, there's something called an Impact Forum going on at 9:30 at University Unitarian Church at on 35th, just above 65th in, I guess that's the Wedgwood neighborhood, is it?
Yeah.
More or less.
Yes.
Starting in mid-April, a nuclear reactor building on the UW campus is going to be demolished. This is after a decade of inactivity. The building, in addition to containing radioactive materials, is a witch's brew of other hazards, including asbestos, PCBs, and lead. Despite the sensitivity of such a project, the University of Washington hired a contractor with an abysmal safety record and a long history of exploiting undocumented workers. There they are again, in order to demolish the building. So students and other community activists are going to talk about what to do about that 9:30 tomorrow morning at University Unitarian.
I got to cut you off after that.
There's just one more. Friday night. This is a big one. Check it out. Marcus Zuniga, the founder of Daily Kos, along with his co-author Jeremy Armstrong, they have a new book out called Crashing the Gate, which is excellent. Check it out. They will be speaking to a packed house, 7 o'clock at the Labor Temple, 2800 Broad.
All right. Well, can't let you do your wrap-up then because of that.
All right.
Talking, as we do every week, with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and you can always find Eat the State online at eatthestate.org.